From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Kelly Flynn. She was America's first woman bomber pilot, but she left the Air Force rather than face court-martial for fraternization, adultery, and lying to her commanding officer. She tells her side of the story in her new memoir, Proud to Be. Then we'll hear from Brigadier General William Moorman, who says Flynn was a good pilot, but displayed conduct unworthy of an officer. And lawyers Peter Sennett and John Marley will discuss their experiences as legal advisors in Rwanda, where about 100,000 people are awaiting trial on charges related to the genocide. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by country singer Shania Twain. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The leaders of Pacific Rim countries who are holding a summit in Western Canada have reached agreement on a plan to bail out Asian economies facing financial hardship. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports from Vancouver.
The framework that will be endorsed later today was first hammered out by APEC finance ministers last week. The plan has three key elements. First, countries in trouble must take tough domestic steps to restore confidence and attract capital. Strengthening the banking system is especially important. Second, the IMF must have a strengthened response, including a large financial commitment up front. The third element of the plan is a backup funding mechanism to supplement IMF money if necessary. Leaders here believe the economic crisis is a serious one, one that President Clinton believes must be approached with determination.
We need to take this very seriously. We need to work very hard at it. We don't need to be at all casual. But we should also have confidence that we can work through it.
The APEC summit concludes later today. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Vancouver.
Defense Secretary William Cohen today warned that if military force should be needed against Iraq, it will be decisive.
There are a number of things that could be done on the part of our allies to, in fact, send the message to Saddam that he must comply fully without resorting to military force. If it is necessary to resort to force, I think you can be reasonably assured it will not be a pinprick.
Cohen says the massive force the United States is putting together in the Persian Gulf is intended to give President Clinton the flexibility he needs to deal with the situation. United Nations weapons inspectors have finished another day of work without interference. A new report shows a massive swing in political money last year away from Democratic candidates toward Republican ones. The Center for Responsive Politics says the change came after the GOP congressional takeover in 1994. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Overall, the report says the 1996 presidential and congressional campaigns cost $2.2 billion. The center put all contributions into 12 categories, and it found just two, lawyers and lobbyists and organized labor, that gave more to Democrats than to Republicans. Larry Makinson is editor of the center's report.
I don't think there's a silver lining at all in this for the Democrats. What the report shows is what people on Capitol Hill have known ever since the Republicans took control in the 1994 elections, which is money follows power big time.
According to the center, business gave more money than labor by a ratio of 11 to 1. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 8 points at 7,759. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, although stocks are lower, at the opening bell on Wall Street, stocks actually moved higher today. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The day began with a sigh of relief that losses in the Japanese stock market overnight weren't more severe in response to the bankruptcy of Yamaichi Securities. The benchmark Nikkei 225 lost 5%. But the market was pressured by a slump in international oil issues, following negative remarks on Amoco at Brown Brothers Harriman. At the same time, high technology shares are mixed. On one hand, Morgan Stanley Dean Witter lowered its earnings forecast for Intel, based on expectations of price cuts for the Pentium II microprocessor. However, there were better-than-expected earnings from Dell Computer. I'm Doug Krisner.
Consumer confidence rebounded this month following a dip in October. The Conference Board says its index of consumer confidence rose 5 points this month, nearly recovering everything it lost last month. Optimism about the strong job market provided a boost to consumers' good feelings. A real estate trade group says October home sales hit a record level. The annual rate of 4.3 million homes is the strongest since the National Association of Realtors began keeping track in 1968. Sales of previously owned homes last month rose 2.1%. Boeing says its 747 production line is back up to full speed. The company last month announced a series of moves intended to help it catch up with an overflow of new orders. Still, Boeing says its factories may not fully recover lost production until next year. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year, Lieutenant Kelly Flynn, the Air Force's first female bomber pilot, resigned from the military. She accepted a general discharge instead of facing a court-martial for having an intimate relationship with a man who was married to an enlisted woman, lying to a superior about the relationship, and disobeying orders to stop seeing the man. She also faced charges of fraternization as a result of an earlier encounter with a military man who was not in her line of command. Flynn faced a possible sentence of 9.5 years. Now Flynn has written a memoir telling her side of the story. Her case created a national controversy. Some say it demonstrated that sexism is deeply ingrained in the military. Some say it showed the inherent problems of bringing more women into the military. Others say it showed Flynn's poor judgment and lack of accountability. I asked Flynn what part of her story she thinks has been most misunderstood.
The most misunderstood has been the Air Force's spin that this was not a story about adultery, it was a story about lying and disobeying an order. The fact of the matter is that they shouldn't have been asking me questions about my sex life in the beginning anyway. I lied initially about sex, and I tried to correct the statement with my commanders, but they'd have none of it. And from then on out, it became this case of a disobedient officer, which is far from the truth.
Well, you had an affair with a married man, but he told you that he was separated. He turned out to be what you describe as a pathological liar. I think most people have had some experience falling in love with the wrong person, but what about lying to the military in a sworn statement saying the relationship with him was platonic when it wasn't?
I lied about sex. It was an area where I tried to get myself out of the situation after being asked the most invasive and most humiliating questions I have ever been subject to concerning my sex life, my preferred sexual positions, how many men I've dated, if I had sex with women, and I wanted to get out of the situation. I immediately knew that I had done something wrong and tried to correct it with my commander.
And
he told me that I should go find defense counsel and that he didn't want to hear anything about it because he could be the ultimate hammer. So I was never given the opportunity to rectify the situation, to correct the statement, to correct my mistake.
But maybe he was the wrong person to speak to and you should have found somebody else. Isn't that what he was telling you?
No, my commander was the person that I should be talking to. He's the one that should have been handling this case in the beginning. He's the one that should have sat down and talked to me about it. So it was what happened was the buck just kept getting passed, and no one would sit down and talk to me about this. So what ultimately happened was the media became the courtroom.
A little later on, when your commanding officer gave you a written order directing you to stay at least 100 yards away from Mark Zego, the man in question, you were, unbeknownst to your commanding officer, living with Zego, and you continued to live with him after you were given this order to stay at least 100 yards away from him and to cease all contact with him. And then after that, you also took him home to meet your family. Tell me about your rationale there for lying and continuing to do something that you were ordered not to do.
Well, as a matter of fact, let me correct one of the statements that you made first and foremost. You said that my commander was not aware Mark Zego was living with me, and that is factually incorrect because I have all the surveillance documents that the security police did on my house, which in fact prove that they knew Mark Zego and myself were living together. The order that was given was factually incorrect. It was unlawful, it was illegal, and it was impossible to obey. The Air Force has no business imposing an order for me not to go home and to go to my bedroom and to go be with whomever I want, especially when they know that person is living in my house, and especially when this woman, his ex-wife, had summoned for divorce on 9 December and had already began the official divorce proceedings 4 days prior to the Air Force giving me an order to stop seeing this man.
Did you ever think that instead of lying, that you would kind of make a case about this and say, you know, you are asking me questions that I think you ethically have no right to ask. This is an example of a bad policy in the military that I object to, instead of just lying.
Had I been a little more streetwise and more legal-wise, I probably would have had thought of that. I was called into the security police room for questioning under false pretenses. I was under the impression that was concerning another lieutenant in another case that I testified against him, when in fact it was because this lieutenant was a complainant against me in this new case. So I was there under false pretenses. I was taken by surprise. I was shocked and I was humiliated, and I didn't have my wits about me to think about how I should handle this. Now, in retrospect, hindsight's 20/20, you're absolutely correct. I should have done something along those lines.
But I think what you're talking about was the first time you were asked about whether you were having an affair with this man. What about the second time when you lied about being in contact with him, you know, after you were given the order to stay?
I never lied about that.
You mean you were just given the order and disobeyed it, is what you're saying?
I was given an order that could not be obeyed. I was given an order that set me up. It goes along with the court-martial handbook that they have that says you need to find more ways to, you need to find more charges to go against them, such as false official statements, because it says this is the surest basis for prosecution. What happened with this order was I was called on a Friday evening at approximately 4:30 in the evening to go see my commander. He said, come in whatever you want. So I had my uniform on and went in my uniform. I walked in, he read me my rights, and then he proceeded to read the order to me. He asked if I wanted to say anything, and I said, not without my lawyer present. And then he asked me to sign a statement that acknowledged that I had read the order and that I received a copy of the order. I never said I would obey this order or that I could follow the order. So it was a situation in which all lines of communication were cut off because my commander read me my rights.
Did you talk to your lawyer after this happened and ask for his or her advice?
I sought counsel. I had to call them because they were in Colorado and it was a Friday evening and they were not available. I didn't speak with them until the next week, after I had to go to my home. The moment I walked out of the office, I disobeyed the order. There was no possible way to obey that order.
What advice did your counsel finally give you?
My counsel said that they'd find some way to handle the order and that eventually I probably should get him out of my life because he was dangerous. I was scared of Mark Zygo. He had threatened to destroy me. He had threatened to destroy my life. He had threatened to kill himself, and he was very unstable, very violent, and I didn't know what he was going to do.
When your commander gave you the order to stop seeing Mark Zygo, to not come within 100 feet of him, and you felt this was an order that was just impossible to obey, what about the order was impossible to obey?
Okay, everything about the order was impossible to obey. First of all, it not only said, do not go within 100 feet of Mark Zygo, it said, do not call Mark Zygo, it said, do not call his work, do not call his home, do not try to contact him through a third party, do not leave a message for him on his answering machine, do not have any form of communication whatsoever. But the most damaging was, as I just mentioned before, was do not talk to him at all through a third party. So I couldn't even tell my commander to tell Mark Zygo to get out of my house. I couldn't tell my lawyers to tell Mark Zygo to get out of my house, because I was disobeying the order if I were to tell anybody to tell Mark Zygo to get out of my house. They broke off every single line of communication that I may have possibly had to tell Mark Zygo to get out of my house unless I were to disobey the order.
When you joined the military, you knew that the military had a different set of rules than civilian life, and by joining, you agreed to follow those rules. So even if you thought some of those rules were unjust, particularly the rules governing private life and sexual conduct, did you feel that it was still your responsibility to obey those rules as a member of the military?
I've always felt it was a responsibility to obey the rules that are out there. Now, the problem lies, and I've also said that I've never thought I should be completely exonerated for breaking a rule or a regulation. I've always said that the punishment should fit the crime, and I made a mistake. And it was an honest mistake, and it wasn't intentionally or it wasn't willful. And what was done was, in my opinion, cruel and unusual punishment to make this a public a public debate and to humiliate myself. And for the Air Force to do that to me publicly was just reprehensible. And for them to continue to say that this was a case about lying and disobeying is also reprehensible, because it started out with them questioning about my consensual sex life. And then it went from there.
What do you think the penalty should have been for your relationship with Mark Zygo?
I think my case should have been handled non-judicially, as almost every other case that has occurred at Minot Air Force Base, whether it be a formal letter of counseling, a letter of reprimand, or an Article 15. This case should never have gone to court. This case should never have been released publicly.
What do you think your penalty should have been for lying under oath to your officer when you told him the relationship was platonic?
I think there really should have been the opportunity to rectify the situation and correct the statement. I think that my commander should have opened the door and let me in and account for my actions of lying. I think the same thing holds true. It should have been the same punishment, because all that kind of runs together. It was the Air Force's way of bringing up more charges so they can have a more severe case against me.
And do you think there should have been a punishment for disobeying the order of not seeing Mark Zygo anymore?
Absolutely not. The order should not have been given in the first place. Well, the question that needs to be asked is, why is the Air Force giving orders to its personnel to stay away from other members and trying to control their personal life, especially when that man had already received copies of his divorce papers? There's no business for the Air Force to be doing that.
Do you think that there should be any rules at all governing the sexual behavior of the military in regards to relationships with other people in the military, or other people who are related to people in the military, or other people who are married at the time of the affair?
I don't think it's anybody's business, especially in militaries, to be imposing rules on how people run their personal and private lives, especially between two consenting adults. And the military, in no way, shape, or form, should be criminalizing these acts. If they're going to handle, if they feel they have to have this need to have control on a personal life, then it should be handled in a non-judicial manner. It should be handled away from the courtrooms, and it should never be made into a felony.
Do you think that there should be no regulations at all about who you can be intimate with within the military?
I think the regulations need to go back to the way they used to be enforced over 200 years ago, when fraternization was defined as some type of influence over another person, or some type of favoritism towards a subordinate. Once women joined, the military in general went completely away from that definition of fraternization and strictly applied it to sex and sex alone. And that needs to stop. It needs to go back to the original way that fraternization was defined, as favoritism.
My guest is Kelly Flynn. She's written a new memoir called Proud to Be. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Kelly Flynn is my guest, and she's written a memoir about her case in the military and about her training in the Air Force called Proud to Be: My Life, the Air Force, the Controversy. As the first woman bomber pilot, you were likely to be carefully watched and used as a role model and a public relations opportunity for the military, and it was probable that people would be watching your every step, and I'm wondering if that ever affected your behavior.
Oh, it most certainly affected my behavior. I knew my every move was being watched for the longest time. If anything, I studied a lot longer and a lot harder than I ever had before. I worked hard at my job. I made sure my boots were shined as bright as they could be every day. I would not socialize with members of the squadron. And it totally affected. I isolated myself from everybody.
You know, how did that affect your choice in men?
Well, it limited it, especially. I didn't really have a whole choice since I decided that I wasn't going to date anyone within my squadron or within my unit because I didn't want to date inside the fishbowl and have the possibility of flying with the person I was dating or may have broken up with. So the dating pool was very limited, and I found a civilian who was interested in me, who told me he was legally separated, had filed for divorce, and that it was perfectly fine to date him.
Mark Zygo, you describe as a pathological liar, and he lied to you in saying, you say that that he was virtually separated from his wife. They weren't. They were still living together, and you found that out when you paid a visit to his house. You also found out that his wife was actually in the military, making things really raising the stakes for you. So, but you continued to see him when you realized that he was lying to you and that you were in a much more dangerous situation. So, should you perhaps have extricated yourself from the relationship then?
I tried to on several occasions to extradite myself from the situation. Let me first say that when Mark and I met his wife and went to the house, they were married, and Mark had no story whatsoever about being separated or divorced. That story came later. A few days later or weeks later on the timeline, after I returned from a trip to Atlanta, that he was now separated and had filed for divorce and would be divorced on December 20th and that the relationship was okay. I was in a clinically defined abusive relationship, and I tried on several times to get out of it. The man threatened me, the man pushed me, and the man was abusive to me both physically and emotionally. I needed help, and I didn't get it. And I didn't seek help initially when I should have. And that was my mistake in doing so. But it was also a mistake of the Air Force in not offering some help, too.
But what you're saying now is that you started the relationship with him when you knew he was still married.
And no, I started the relationship with him when he told me he was legally separated and that he had filed for divorce.
But then when you saw that they were living together, you knew that they weren't legally separated.
No, I did not know anything of the sort. I was told by Mark Zygo that he was legally separated. They were living in separate bedrooms until the divorce was final.
Getting back to the idea of you as the first woman bomber pilot in the Air Force being this kind of role model on public relations opportunity, were there times that you felt most of all that you were being watched? I mean, before you were called out on your affair?
Well, from the moment that I selected the B-52 and found out that I had earned some title along with it, the first female B-52 pilot, from that moment on, I knew I was being watched. My first flight in a B-52, I flew with a colonel, a squadron commander. And then from then on, once I arrived at Minot, there were times when I just flew with a colonel after colonel after colonel, and everybody was, you know, wanted to fly with me for some reason. I couldn't figure out why I couldn't just fly with my aircraft commander or captain. Why did I always have to have colonels on board? I was watched all the time.
And what impact did that have on you? Did you like that? Did you feel honored by the attention?
No, I hated the attention. It was very frustrating because I tried to blend in. I tried to be one of the guys, but you really can't blend in when you've got the Air Force sticking you out there saying, look, this is a woman flying the B-52. And then when I'm walking around having camera crews following me everywhere, I'm walking around and I have colonels following me everywhere, and none of the men do. It's tough to blend in. It makes you even more lonely and more isolated than you really are.
How did you become the first woman to fly a B-52?
It was by luck. At the end of pilot training, what happens is the Air Force has, say, 20 available airplanes to choose from, and there are 20 students, and you pick based on your ranking at the end of pilot training. And I was in the middle of my class, and that was the available combat aircraft that I wanted, so that's what I picked.
Were there ways that you thought the Air Force wasn't really prepared for women?
I think that the military in general wasn't really prepared for women, and the fact that the way they handled it, I can see how it's difficult because a lot of women have different views on how to handle their job, and just as we have different opinions on how to get equality. I think there's a point now that the military has to stop looking at women as just people who are the opposite sex and who get involved in sexual relationships with members in the military. They need to start looking at women as an asset, as people who can do the job, as other professionals.
There are some ways, just really practical ways, that you thought it was difficult for a woman? And I'm talking about, for instance, the uniforms that women wore. Were those uniforms sized for men?
The uniforms that we wore as cadets, the first thing I noticed was during basic training, I was issued a very huge, large pair of underwear that they were huge. They went pretty much all the way up to my chest, and we had to shove them in these really short shorts. So in that area, they definitely weren't sized to fit women. But there are other areas, too. The uniforms were not very flattering. If you gained even a quarter of an inch on your waist, everybody knew about it and everybody talked about it. The uniforms that are still issued today, I can tell you, I still have about 6 or 7 pair of long underwear, Nomex long underwear for flying that I was issued. It's all men's long underwear. And that's all they issue women now is men's long underwear. I think it's time that they can probably start to focus on the women and realize that we wear women's long underwear too. And my flight gloves never fit, so yeah.
I don't know if you feel like going into this or not, but there seemed to be no facility for dealing with a woman having to relieve herself when flying a B-52.
It's pretty funny. That was one of the issues that was highly discussed, and the questions that people wanted to know was how I went to the bathroom on the B-52. And they did some modification. They tried to build these curtains around it, and it didn't work out, so I made a special modification and bought something out of a flying magazine. But no, they weren't really prepared. But the women had been flying on B-52s for a while. There were women crew chiefs who went for rides on B-52s before. So it's a fact of life, and I think men in the military have to accept that women are here to stay.
What's it like to fly a B-52?
Oh, it's one of the most wonderful experiences. The B-52 is unlike any other plane that's out there. It's aerodynamically different. It's very huge, and it's lumbering, but it's extremely graceful. And you have to anticipate its moves so much because it's like a big, huge ball of inertia that's out there that you're trying to control.
What about flying in formation? What does that feel like, and what did you like about that?
Well, flying in formation is different for each aircraft, and flying in formation in the training planes, the smaller planes, is one of the most exciting experiences I've ever done. Flying in a T-38, which is a small, sleek, jet-like aircraft, we'd fly approximately 3 feet from our buddy off their wing, and we're going about, I don't know, 400 to 500 miles per hour through the sky. And it's a rush. It takes a lot of concentration, though, and it takes a lot of effort. But once you get it, it's one of the most graceful things I think that's ever done.
What impact do you think your case is going to have on the future of women in the Air Force? Any ideas?
Well, I'd like to think that my case isn't just going to impact women. I hope that it's going to impact men in the military, too. I'd like to think that I'm going to be a catalyst for change, especially in regards to the judicial system and the consensual sex rules, and that the military will find some type of reform and create a better and stronger environment for the people who are working in it.
Kelly Flynn, her new memoir is called Proud to Be. We'll hear from Brigadier General William Moorman in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Brigadier General William Moorman discusses Air Force regulations on sexual conduct. Also, we'll hear from Peter Sennett and John Marley, two legal advisors in Rwanda, where over 100,000 suspects are being held on charges related to the genocide. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by country singer Shania Twain. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In our interview with Kelly Flynn, she posed the question, why should the military criminalize relations between consenting adults? Flynn was forced to resign from the Air Force after having a relationship with a man married to an enlisted woman and lying about it to her commander. We called Brigadier General William Moorman, staff judge advocate for Air Force Command, and asked him Flynn's question, why should the military criminalize sexual relations between consenting adults?
Well, let me say this. The Air Force or the military in general is not primarily interested in intimate relations between consenting adults. The real issue in the Lieutenant Flynn case had to do with impact on good order and discipline. And the military is always interested in any kind of activity that has an adverse impact on good order and discipline.
Are you talking about good order and discipline because of her responses to questions when she wasn't being honest?
No. Let me clarify. The conduct in which she engaged, both fraternization and adultery with the husband of an enlisted military member, had a direct impact on good order and discipline. With regard to fraternization, we have long recognized that unprofessional relationships between officers and enlisted persons can cause a breakdown of the team efforts that we need to have in order to have a well-functioning military. With regard to the adultery, in this particular case, where the other party's spouse is a very junior military person, Lieutenant Flynn's conduct had a direct impact on that individual and on that individual's unit and on the morale and discipline of a substantial number of people at Minot Air Force Base.
So what are the general principles that underline the military's regulations?
Well, there are really two.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, with regard to fraternization, our concern there is that our enlisted force has a right to believe that the officers who are appointed over them make decisions based on the best interests of the military unit involved and not based on their own personal preferences, not based on friendships or other unprofessional relationships that they may form with the enlisted cadre for whom they're responsible. And therefore, we have an interest and have had such an interest for the 200 years plus that the American military has existed in not fostering unprofessional relationships between officers and enlisted persons. With regard to adultery, adultery comes under our Article 134 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And that article specifies that the offenses listed there are not crimes unless they have an impact on good order and discipline or bring discredit on the services. And that kind of discredit is not simply someone's moral judgment. It's something that you can demonstrate in terms of an impact on the unit. In this particular case, the adultery involved here was with the husband of a junior military person. That junior military person found out about it, found it necessary to go to her chain of command, involve her chain of command in trying to solve the problem, and then ultimately, of course, had to complain to the wing commander at Minot in order to try and get some relief from Lieutenant Flynn's activities.
How would you interpret the moral of the Kelly Flynn story?
I think if you wanted to capture it in a nutshell, what you would say is that the Kelly Flynn story is an unfortunate example of an officer who was good at her specialty, in this case being a pilot, but failed in her responsibilities to also act as an officer and to set standards that officers are expected to set.
Is there anything you think that the Air Force would have done differently if given the chance to do it again?
In this particular case, I think not. The course of conduct that the Air Force followed was really set by Lieutenant Flynn's course of conduct. Had she not lied under oath, had she not willfully violated the written order of her commander, we may have had a different disposition in this case. But given the fact that first she committed the offenses of fraternization and then adultery, the fact that she was warned that she should stop and in fact agreed to do so at one time, the fact that she was advised of her rights to not say anything and yet gave detailed written statements under oath that contained lies, and then when the entire matter was brought to the attention of her senior commander by Airman Zygo, she was given a written order which she chose to disregard, and I am told she disregarded it even though her own attorneys advised her that she should comply with it. Under those circumstances, it would be very difficult for me to see that this case could have been otherwise disposed of.
She says that, the order to stop seeing Zygo would have been impossible to fulfill because he was already living at her house, and the order also said that she couldn't communicate to him through a third party or leave a message on his answering machine. So unless she never went home again, that would have been an impossible-to-enforce order.
Well, of course, the commanders involved had no idea that she was living with Mr. Zygo at the time that they gave her this written order.
Although she says surveillance was done on her house and they knew about that.
Well, and
I mean, this is what I don't know, but
sure.
This is what she says and what she writes in her new book.
Well, I think in that regard her book is in error. The commanders did not know that she was living with Mr. Zygo when they gave her the order. And it would have been an easy thing for her at that point to go to her attorney and tell her attorney that she wanted Mr. Zygo out of the house. So there are ample opportunities for her to break off this relationship after she got the written order.
Kelly Flynn says that she knows, she made mistakes here, but that she doesn't think criminal prosecution was the appropriate way to go. What would your response to that be?
I think that if we focus on the real offenses here, the offenses that made this case proceed in the manner that it did, and those offenses are overwhelmingly the offenses of lying under oath and failing to obey the orders of her superior officers, those two offenses run so contrary to her oath as an Air Force officer that there was simply no opportunity to dispose of these charges in any other forum. Now, with regard to that, I should say that in every case where a court-martial is pending, the officer involved has an opportunity to offer to resign in lieu of court-martial, and of course that's what was done in this case, and the secretary exercised her prerogatives in approving that discharge.
General Moorman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome.
Brigadier General William Moorman is Staff Judge Advocate for Air Force Command. Coming up, Rwanda's judicial system trying to deal with the after effects of genocide. This is Fresh Air. the victims of the genocide in Rwanda was the country's legal system. Now, as the legal system tries to rebuild itself, it's faced with over 100,000 people who've been arrested for participating in the genocide and are now awaiting trial. My guests, Major Peter Sennett and Captain John Marley, are working as legal advisors to Rwanda's justice system through a project of the Naval Justice Academy. They were last in Rwanda in August. Sennett and Marley are in the U.S. Marine Corps Reserves and both work in private legal practices. When we invited them for an interview, they made it clear they were speaking for themselves, not as representatives of the U.S. military. I asked them what the odds are that 100,000 people will actually come to trial.
Well, the numbers that you'll see in most of the reports are that at the current rate they're going, we're talking anywhere from 300 to 400 years in order to process all these cases. So the current thinking is that somewhere down the line, this is going to break off, and they are going to pursue an amnesty panel, similar to South Africa's Reconciliation Commission. In all likelihood, they're going to narrow this down to prosecuting the worst offenders that they can identify, and then as the country continues to stabilize, they will make a move to pursue some kind of amnesty panel that will alleviate the remaining individuals being held for participation in the massacre.
Now, Terry, that's not without tremendous controversy, though, within the country. I mean, the Rwandan people themselves are not exactly pleased with what the international tribunals have been doing, the pace at which those have been going, and how few people have been brought to justice. The trials are taking outside of the country, and a lot of Rwandese citizens don't feel as though justice is being done to the victims of the massacre. And when people talk about letting people out of the jails and to relieve some of the crowding of being more selective in the prosecution, there are many people who are very upset, Rwandese citizens, not just people in the government, who are upset at the idea of letting people go who were involved in massacres because you can't try all these people.
Captain Morley, what are some of the basics you're trying to teach to people in the justice system in Rwanda now?
Well, Terry, we've worked with both military and civilian prosecutors in Rwanda, and I think any good prosecution starts with a good investigation and explaining that not only to the criminal investigators but to the prosecutors as well. For a long time, unfortunately, I think a lot of the criminal investigations began and ended with a confession. And, of course, any good prosecutor or investigator here in the United States would tell you that you need more than just a confession. You need corroboration. You need physical evidence. And sort of emphasizing that a confession is not a bad thing to have, but you need corroboration. You need other evidence. And having them understand that as a foundation for the prosecution. From there, taking them into opening statements, a theory of your case, what's your case about, building a case, what are the elements of the crime, and then obviously using witnesses, demonstrative evidence, the use of demonstrative evidence, charts and diagrams in court, for example, where a genocide took place, is sort of new to a lot of the prosecutors there.
What reaction do you get from prosecutors in Rwanda when you say a confession isn't enough?
Well, they smile at you and they want to know why. I mean, a confession is, in one way, sort of the strongest proof of guilt. But you explain to them that people can and will recant from a confession, that very often human rights organizations will accuse the government of extracting a confession improperly from someone, and it just is not as strong as evidence as it seems, and it needs to be corroborated if you want the trials to be fair.
Are you also having to teach people in Rwanda that you can't beat a confession out of somebody, you can't coerce a confession?
Oh, they're actually, I think, understand that pretty well. At one point during our discussion, we were getting into the distinctions between tricking someone into confessing, for example, telling them that we have evidence against them, which you really don't have, and actually coercing someone against their will. And they actually stopped me halfway through the class and said, "Excuse me, Captain Marley, but that's not correct. You should never trick someone into confessing. A confession has to be of their own free will." And they proceeded to lecture me about what the proper standard was, and were not willing to make such a fine distinction as U.S. law makes about perhaps deception to get a confession. So I think they have a pretty good idea of what their responsibilities are.
Where were they getting that standard from, that it's inappropriate to trick a confession out of someone?
Well, actually, I think that came up. They had recently received some training from an organization out of Belgium called Advocates Sans Frontières.
Lawyers Without Borders.
Right, which had recently given them some training in the criminal justice area. And there are some systems of justice in Europe and other places that don't make a distinction between getting a confession through trickery and coercion, whereas the U.S. Criminal justice system makes a distinction legally between a confession which you may have tricked someone into making, but is still not a coerced confession and is admissible in court.
What about teaching the basics of forensics? Is that going to be useful in the genocide trials?
They're very interested in forensics, and I don't know if it's because they were following the O.J. trial over in Rwanda, but they have a great appreciation for and a great yearning to do more in the way of forensic evidence, whether it's blood analysis, DNA, fingerprint technology. Unfortunately, the state of affairs of forensic evidence in Rwanda, it's really back maybe about 50 or 60 years from where we are today. And that was one of the things that we tried in our training, to get them back to sort of a basics of forensics. I mean, you may not have DNA, but there are shell casings you can examine. A simple fingerprint analysis, hair and fiber, you may not be able to do with the degree of precision that we do in labs here in the United States, but you can make a persuasive argument from some very basic forensics.
I imagine a lot of the evidence against the people accused of genocide will be eyewitness accounts from people who were survivors and from people who watched and survived during the genocide. Are these people coming forward?
No, unfortunately, and that's exactly correct. Almost exclusively, the evidence is coming from eyewitness testimony, and unfortunately, in light of the fear of retribution from individuals who have not been caught or are not in jail, the potential witnesses are very reluctant to cooperate, and those who have are very reluctant to give enough information that would lead to a successful prosecution. And there is quite a bit of documentation that you can find in the press of individuals disappearing or being attacked in light of the fact that they have spoken with investigators. And that actually has been part of the training that not only we have engaged in, but others as well, about how to go about taking a statement and how to go about obtaining information from potential witnesses without waving a big red flag that says you're from the prosecution team and you're talking to this individual and that individual in a particular village, because that, in effect, makes them a target.
So how would you recommend going about it?
Well, in a much more low-key manner, of course, that you're not taking the vehicle that's stamped, UN Office of Investigations or something like that, and driving right into the middle of the village and parking in front of the individual's house and walking in. And sometimes the investigators travel with military personnel as well if they anticipate taking someone into custody. Rather that, of course, you would try to establish a neutral meeting point or try to encounter an individual out on the street rather than going directly to their house or going to their place of work where they're going to be witnesses to this interaction between that individual and the investigator.
Mm-hmm. Have either of you been to the mass graves in Rwanda?
Yes, Terry, we have. We went to a school building outside of the town of Gikongoro where a massacre, some people estimate over 25,000 people were killed there of men, women, and children. They've disinterred about 9,000 or 10,000 people, and they're setting this school up into a national Holocaust museum. We went there back in September of '96 when they were still disinterring bodies, and the site is almost indescribable of 8,000 or 9,000 women and children having recently been disinterred. It was really an awful sight.
When do you go back to Rwanda, and what's the next step for you there?
Well, we're hoping to return sometime this spring. That'll be contingent on funding of the program. And the next step that we're going to take there is actually still up in the air to some extent because it hinges largely on the progress that they're making and the issues that they confront that are most topical for them. So what we actually get into will depend largely on what kind of feedback we get through our counterparts in the justice system there and through personnel at the embassy.
Captain Morley, any final words?
I'm optimistic. The people that we've worked with there, they have a keen sense of justice. And for them, that doesn't necessarily mean getting convictions on everybody or making everyone pay who they think was involved in the genocide. There have been acquittals. They do have a keen sense of justice and what's right and wrong. They want to do the right thing. There could have been an awful massacre in this country when the RPF took the country back and stopped the genocide. All those people who are now herded in prisons could have been themselves been massacred. And the fact that, although they are in some pretty horrible conditions, the fact that the country is trying to try these people and bring these people to justice tells you a lot about the Rwandese sense of justice. And I think the fact that they're committed to reconciliation in the country and bringing the country back together again.
Thank you both very much for talking with us.
And thank you very much.
Thank you, Jerry.
Captain John Morley and Major Peter Sinnott are working as legal advisors to Rwanda's justice system through a project of the Naval Justice Academy. Coming up, a new CD by country singer Shania Twain. This is Fresh Air. Country singer Shania Twain's 1995 album, The Woman in Me, sold more than 10 million copies, an amazing number for a genre dominated by men and in a general sales decline. That record pushed Twain to the forefront of country music. Now only Garth Brooks and Leanne Rimes are as popular. Twain's new album, called Come On Over, has just been released, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Whenever I talk about country music here, I spend my time promoting the hardcore stuff, old-fashioned country with a sharp twang and plaintive pedal steel guitar. As a reactionary in this area, I'm obliged to think that the vast majority of what is marketed as country music is little better than watered-down rock and roll. Yet I find myself liking the new Shania Twain CD a lot. This despite the fact that her stuff is the very definition of 90s country music, tidy and crisp, featuring melodies and instrumentation that would not at all be out of place on a middle-of-the-road rock record. Life was going great, love was gonna have to wait, was it no hurry, had no worries, staying single was the plan, didn't need a steady man, I had it covered, till I discovered that love. Shania Twain has won me, and more importantly, millions of more casual listeners, over on the strength of music making so adroitly calculated that it inspires not contempt, but admiration. Her album is generous by industry standards, over an hour of music where your usual country CD clocks in at about half of that. The 16, count 'em, 16 songs on Come On Over were all co-written by Twain and her husband, who also happens to be her producer, Robert Mutt Lang. Lang built his reputation in the 70s and 80s, producing irresistible hits for heavy metal boys like AC/DC and Def Leppard. Now Lang applies his talent to peppery post-feminist songs like this silly thing called Man, I Feel Like a Woman. I'm going out tonight, I'm feeling all right, gonna let it all hang out, wanna make some noise.
Yeah, I wanna scream and shout. No inhibitions, make no conditions, get a little out of line. I ain't gonna act politically correct, I only wanna have a good time.
As a producer, Mutt Lange's method is to push Twain's voice way forward in the mix to achieve a startling intimacy and to articulate the melody via hard rock lead guitar lines. There are times when he and Twain abandon the pretense that they're making country music at all, as on this song called When.
If elephants could fly, I'd be a little more optimistic, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. I don't mean to sound so pessimistic, but I don't think that cow really jumped over the moon. When will I wake up? Why did we break up? When will we make up? When money grows on trees, people live in peace, everyone agrees. When happiness is free, love can guarantee you'll come back to me. That's when. Yeah.
Now that sounds more like a good Blondie single from 20 years ago, or the best new song Celine Dion will never record. What Shania Twain and Mutt Lange are doing is crafting some of the catchiest music around. Twain makes the most of a rather thin voice of limited range by singing in a conversational tone. That's a standard pop song strategy, of course, but Twain is really good at it. In fact, she's really good at pulling off clever variations on all sorts of standard pop culture strategies. In her videos and album packaging, she plays up her curvy figure with a humorous, self-aware manner that keeps her from becoming the Pamela Lee of country. But in other ways, she's withheld herself from her public. Unlike every other country singer in history, she never toured to promote that 10 million-selling album. By waiting to tour until sometime next year, she's built up a tremendous amount of interest. Like everything else that Twain and her husband collaborator do, it's shrewd in a way that transcends cynicism to attain the promise of pleasure. Right now, Shania Twain is turning the middle of the road into the most intriguing place a country singer can be.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Shania Twain's CD, Come On Over. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Together.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of The Gin in the Nightingale's Eye, Five Fairy Stories by A.S. Byatt. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We often play the music of pianist Jessica Williams on Fresh Air. We finally got her to come to our studio to record a concert and interview. We'll present it on our next program. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.